In our first story, behind mansion walls, American royalty is stained by blood.
After the first two shots, my mom came outside, heard my dad scream.
It was pretty obvious he was a crazy man with access to a lot of weapons.
And later, Las Vegas high life sends a respected dynasty to a new low.
He fancied himself a hitman, a James Bond, a type of character.
There's drugs, there's betrayal, murder. I was just surprised how one wealthy family can be involved in so much weird stuff.
I'm Christopher Mason. The DuPonts are one of America's wealthiest families. But you'd be surprised by the skeletons lurking in their closets and how they became a fatal dynasty.
West of Philadelphia is a land far out of reach of the average American. It's called the Main Line. An exclusive stretch of grand mansions, vast estates, and country clubs. Mere millionaires are small change on the Main Line. This is billionaire country.
Fancy playing croquet on the lawn? Perhaps a spot of tea after the morning fox hunt? For generations, the establishment families of the Main Line led a wonderful life, far from the prying eyes of the hoi polloi. One event would change all that. Murder.
January 26th, 1996. Olympic gold medalist and a regular Main Line visitor, Dave Schultz, is on one of the wealthy estates, fixing his car radio.
Hey, Ned, it's working. Come listen.
My dad was working on something in his car, and he pulled up and he said, "You have a problem with me?"
You got a problem with me?
Immediately took out a big gun and was filled with hollow point bullets. Oh! And hit him with it twice in the chest. After the first two shots, my mom came outside, heard my dad scream.
Stop it!
Point a gun at my mom.
The police are coming!
My mom ducked back inside, immediately called the police, and he took one more shot and hit him in the back. My mom ran outside and just told my dad.
Alexander Schultz is just 9. When his father is shot down. To this day, he still finds it hard to comprehend.
Just no explanation. I think that was the hardest part, is that it wasn't from anything, you know? So that was really, when you have a tragedy like that, you want someone to tell you at least why it happened, you know?
The killing seems senseless, and even more bizarre is where it happens, on property owned by an heir to one of America's biggest industrial fortunes, DuPont.
The 19th century leaders of industry in America amassed enormous fortunes, large enough to sustain wealth through several generations. And the DuPont family, I believe, would be in the top 10 of those.
Eleuthère Irene DuPont founded an industrial empire back in 1802. His first millions came from gunpowder and a lucrative contract with the U.S. military. Over 200 years, the DuPont company grew to become America's biggest chemical firm, with annual revenue estimated at $40 billion. Many of Eleuthère's descendants will be born rich.
Generation after generation were able to afford the finest things in life, to live in luxury, to have assets such that they could be charitable donors, philanthropists, explore whatever they wished in life.
John DuPont is a great-great-great-grandson of the DuPont Company founder. His share of the DuPont inheritance is thought to be hundreds of millions of dollars. But it won't just be this heir's money that makes him different.
John, you're late.
Born in 1938, young John grows up on a sprawling estate known as Foxcatcher Farm. Locked behind miles of fencing and security checkpoints, it's 800 acres of America's most exclusive real estate.
The upper end of it was a working dairy farm. Then you had a large area of woods. The mansion house itself is enormous.
But at its heart, Foxcatcher Farm is empty. John's parents divorce when he's 2 years old. His older brother and sisters are away at boarding school. So he lives alone with his mother, Jean, in elegant isolation.
Alone on his vast estate, young John DuPont has one companion, Hubie, son of the family chauffeur. But John's only friend is also on the DuPont payroll. John's mother, Jean, pays Hubie to play with her son at a rate of 90 cents an hour.
As the years go by, John's isolation only gets worse. His social skills never flourish.
He was an odd fellow who was not really going to do well in a marriage or at cocktail parties.
Instead of people, he turns to animals for company. As a young teenager, he becomes enamored with natural history.
He actually earned a doctorate and was an ornithologist of some note.
A Filipino parrot and a Mexican sparrow are named in his honor. But like so many other things in his life, his mother makes much of this happen, buying him vast scientific collections to play with. John learns a lifelong lesson. What he can't earn on his own merits, DuPont money can buy.
He could do very well when he was the man paying the bills and commanding the respect of others through his assets.
In 1962, at age 24, John discovers a new obsession, competitive sports. Lack of natural talent won't hold him back when he decides he wants to be an Olympic athlete.
He buys his way onto elite training squads for swimming and pentathlon, but even the DuPont millions can't make him swim quickly enough to qualify. There must be another way to bask in the glory of Olympic gold.
In 1984, John DuPont buys a new collection that will rival his stuffed creatures. Wrestlers.
Okay, boys.
Having failed to excel at the sport himself, he resorts to buying success.
Get serious.
In this case, a potential U.S. Olympic team.
He was a frustrated athlete who had these millions to make it possible to hang out with athletes and coaches that were the best in the United States.
In 1989, at age 41, John splurges on a $600,000 wrestling facility at Foxcatcher Farm. Then he spends more money, paying Olympic hopefuls to move in and train for the 1996 Atlanta Games.
Yes, yes.
His chief draw, gold medalist coach Dave Schultz, an American wrestling hero and father to young Alexander Schultz.
He was a rock star, really within that wrestling niche.
For a time, the wrestlers seemed to enjoy the opportunity. The best coach, the best facilities, completely paid for.
America's top piggyback.
For both sides, it's a win-win.
The wealthy are surrounded by people who want some of what they have. And because they want some of the wealth, they cater to the egos of the wealthy, tell them what they want to hear, behave as they're ordered to behave, and try to keep in good graces.
So what possibly could have gone so wrong that afternoon on Foxcatcher Farm? when John DuPont's prized wrestling coach, David Schultz, is gunned down, defenseless. Oh!
My friend had just been shot, and the person who had just shot him, his whereabouts were unknown.
It's a day Mike Savitsky will never forget, as the first cop on the scene and as the victim's friend.
My immediate reaction was, there's my friend on the ground, I gotta help him. And that's what I did.
Come on, stay with me, buddy. Come on.
I checked him for signs of life, breathing pulse, did not find any. And at that point, I began to administer CPR. And as I would pump air in, I could hear it coming back out through his chest.
Dave Schultz dies in his friend's arms. His wife blurts out the truth. She knows who shot her husband.
Get John DuPont, please.
John DuPont.
I was very upset by that. And there was definitely a feeling that, you know, we have to get him and arrest him and bring him to justice.
But DuPont has barricaded himself inside his mansion. Can they get him out before someone else is killed?
We knew that he was armed. We knew from prior history he had a large collection of firearms. He had a safe room. It was almost like a vault. He could lock himself inside.
The main line, west of Philadelphia, winter 1996. John DuPont has just murdered an Olympic hero. Now, he's holed up inside his mansion with a stockpile of high-powered weapons. Police call in reinforcements.
There were probably 20 or 30 police departments involved. Five separate SWAT teams involved.
For years, John DuPont enjoyed the spoils of the landed gentry. Now, his mansion is a prison.
It's a showdown at Foxcatcher Farm. And the question is, will the DuPont fortune buy John out of this?
One of John's other Olympic pursuits is target shooting. He's also an avid hunter. Everyone on the estate is at risk.
He had a safe room. It was almost like a vault. He could lock himself inside. And there was quite a bit of weaponry in the house.
Police have no idea how this will end. And the closer they look into the life of John DuPont, the more worried they get.
He would talk about people being in walls. And he just had general paranoia.
It turns out John DuPont is quite the eccentric.
Get out of my house.
Alexander Schultz remembers his weird mix of sanity and delusion.
He was, you know, hearing people and thought, he's paranoid, very paranoid, thought people were out to get him. I mean, this was mixed in with sanity. You know, it wasn't just this guy babbling to himself all the time. This was, you know, he was coherent a lot of the time too.
But coherence is often a stranger to the master of Foxcatcher Farm. He sees Nazis in the trees. Swans try to hypnotize him. He worries that an imaginary goo machine will make his mansion disappear.
After several hours under siege, the madness rears its head.
He was demanding to be called Dalai Lama. Several times he had made threats that he had, I believe the term used was toys.
I will use my toys.
That he would use on any police officers that approached the mansion.
At various times, he calls himself Jesus and the President of the United States.
At that point in time, it was pretty obvious he was a crazy man with access to a lot of weapons.
But no matter how mad their quarry, cops can't forget they're laying siege to a descendant of an American icon. They don't storm the mansion.
They definitely wanted to take him alive. They did not want to have to hurt him or whatever, you know, let justice be served through the court systems. The decision was made to wait it out.
24 hours later, the eccentric millionaire is still holding out.
There were rumors that it had a supply of food and water that it could be used as a safe refuge in case of a war.
With DuPont bunkered down, police start piecing together his original crime. The surprise murder of his former friend, Olympic wrestling coach David Schultz.
The most likely explanation of most of his odd behavior was that he suffered from schizophrenia.
Forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz interviewed DuPont.
In DuPont's case, it was quite extreme. The man had been mentally ill for years.
It was bound to happen with him. He was on the precipice of doing something like this.
Hey, John.
Alexander Schultz recalls how his father had a falling out with his benefactor.
I remember the Christmas before my dad's murder, there was like rumblings of that we were gonna have to move because, you know, John was gonna fire him because he thought he was out, you know, my dad was out for him in some sort of way.
Despite years of loyal friendship, David Schultz becomes a marked man.
The motive had to do with his mistaken belief that Schultz was damaging his reputation in the wrestling world.
Deluded by schizophrenia, John is convinced the wrestlers hold him in contempt.
Come on. As much money as John DuPont had, and in whatever aspirations he had to be a wrestler and to be part of that wrestling community, he did not have the level of talent nor the level of respect that Dave Schultz commanded both as a wrestler and as a coach.
Mike Savitsky believes that John DuPont's paranoia may have been fueled by sycophantic friends eager to find his favor and share his money.
The situation was made worse because people fed off of John for their own personal gain. They heightened his paranoias, and ultimately they triggered what happened.
To this day, it's unclear exactly what tipped John DuPont over the edge. But it was a fatal turning point. After 2 days outside in the dead of winter, the cops are losing patience. But instead of storming the mansion, they try another tactic.
They cut off his heat to his mansion, and it was very cold.
It's the break they're waiting for.
So during the negotiation, he just announced to the negotiators that he was going out to fix the heaters. And he was going to grab a wrench and walk out there and fix it himself.
The SWAT team is on edge.
Hold right there, sir.
Will DuPont go down without a fight?
Put your hands up.
Without police firing a shot, one of the strangest chapters in mainline history is over. But another type of siege is about to begin in court.
If John DuPont is mentally ill, does he qualify for a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity? Could he really get away with murder?
You got a problem with me?
Few doubt John DuPont pulled the trigger, then fled to his mansion. But to convict him of murder, prosecutors have to prove he is not insane.
In Pennsylvania, as in many American states, the test of insanity requires the following elements. First, the person has to have a mental disease or defect.
DuPont is found to suffer from schizophrenia.
Second, as a result of that mental illness, the person has to either be unable to tell what they're doing or not know it's wrong.
The prosecution argues that despite DuPont's illness, he still knew right from wrong.
He knew that Dave Schultz was a human and that shooting him could harm or kill him. As long as John DuPont knew he was shooting and harming a human being and knew it was against the law, he's legally sane and responsible, even though he was mentally ill.
John DuPont is found guilty of murder, but he's also deemed to be mentally ill. His sentence is relatively light, 15 to 30 years. The grand mansion on Foxcatcher Farm is replaced by an 8x10 cell. His fortune can't help him now. In 2010, at age 72, John DuPont dies in prison.
Could the murder of Dave Schultz have been avoided? If you or I exhibited the madness of John DuPont, we'd quickly end up in psychiatric care. But many people lived off John's wealth. So his mental illness was either indulged or ignored. And a much-loved Olympic hero paid with his life.
Coming up behind mansion walls.
She was DuPont money. She was born rich. She spent her whole life fabulously wealthy.
High society collides with Las Vegas lowlife.
He was just a stone-cold killer.
And the DuPont name is tainted once again. When dollars come to Las Vegas, Nevada, they rarely leave in the same wallet. No matter how wealthy you are when you arrive, odds are you'll leave poorer.
Now to a rather unpleasant story. The body of a deceased woman was found today.
In a seedy Sin City motel in August 1998, a DuPont heir loses more than money.
When the hotel employee went to the Del Mar was used by prostitutes, drug users. They would rent it by the hour.
The horror begins when a maid complains about the stench in room 6. It's coming from the air conditioning vent.
They took off the panel. They see a garbage bag. The maintenance man reaches in, starts to drag out the bag, rips the bag open, and realizes that this is a body in here.
High society can have a dark underbelly. This is a tale of greed, manipulation, and espionage. It will soon lead to a grand mansion on Philadelphia's main line. But on this hot August night in Nevada, the police have no name, no motive, not one clue.
For 3 days, no one seems to miss the dead woman. Then, police get a call.
I need to talk to the police.
Dean McGuigan, who was a member of the DuPont family, had reported to the police that his girlfriend was missing.
Dean McGuigan, 42, is one of many heirs that DuPont money nourishes as it trickles down. Dean is related to convicted murderer John DuPont, who killed his star wrestling coach a year earlier. Now, another untimely death lands on the DuPont doorstep.
It's my girlfriend.
The Las Vegas Metro homicide detectives immediately knew from his description of her that the body they had recovered at the Del Mar was, in fact, Patricia Margiello.
45-year-old Patricia Margiello isn't a high-flying society wife, the type the DuPont name is usually associated with. Far from it.
Patty Margiello was a drug addict, a prostitute, out of the Philadelphia area. A girlfriend of Dean that had followed him to Las Vegas. Somebody that the family, the DuPont family, didn't approve of.
And Patty's not the only one.
Mother, you want to see?
Yes, come in and sit down.
Dean hasn't exactly done the dynasty proud.
Dean was the product of rich parents. He had everything given to him, therefore he really accomplished nothing.
But he does manage to develop a drug addiction and a felony conviction. It's a great disappointment to his mother, thrice married Lisa Dean Chendor McGuigan Mosley.
I don't know what to do about this. I've just about reached the end of my tether.
She shows her disapproval by periodically cutting off his money.
So I've made a decision.
Dean had a trust fund that he was living off of. His mother, Lisa, sometimes took his access to the trust fund away.
I'm going to cut your allowance in half.
What? Oh, how do you expect me to live on that?
I expect you to get a job and hold it.
He did, for a while, work as a waiter at a restaurant and was earning $2.10 an hour, plus tips.
Either you get a job, or I cut you off completely.
At that time, his mother had taken his money away.
Dean's mother would like to see her son divorce his wife, Linda.
In 1992, Dean married a woman named Linda, who was a regular working-class woman, and they seemed happy, although he was addicted to drugs, and she asked him repeatedly to go get help for his drug addiction.
Yeah, that's rich coming from you, real rich.
Lisa didn't like her. The two never got along.
Although Dean separates from his wife, he doesn't immediately file for divorce. Instead, in 1995, Dean starts a relationship with a girl he meets in drug rehab. Patty Margiela.
She was a part-time prostitute, a full-time drug addict, and her teeth were missing.
Patty is everything a DuPont descendant shouldn't be. Dean doesn't care. But his mother does.
Patty really upset the family. They had tried to pay her off before to leave to get away from Dean. That didn't work. She just kept coming back into his life.
Fed up, Dean's mother turns off the money tap until he comes to his senses.
Okay, we're going tomorrow, Mom.
You're going now.
In 1998, Dean decides to start divorce proceedings against his wife and moves into a Las Vegas hotel. To his family's chagrin, he flies Patty out from Philadelphia to join him.
The reason that Dean was pretty much living on cat food was because his mother took away access to his trust fund, mainly because she didn't approve of his girlfriend, Patty.
But now, Patty is dead. The FBI is called in. And right away, two things strike Agent Brett Shields as odd. Dean has facial injuries.
I think it's my girlfriend.
And it's taken him 3 days to report his girlfriend missing.
Dean was my main suspect at that time. And here we had a guy that had a broken nose. He hadn't reported his girlfriend missing for 3 days.
So this is just a coincidence.
Oh, I think I got slugged.
I was grilling him.
Right.
It was not a good cop, bad cop thing. It was a bad cop interview.
So what you're saying is that
Dean says the night Patty went missing, he left her in his hotel bar to earn some money.
Dean told the police he last saw her in the bar at the Hilton. She was supposed to get paid $2,000 for entertaining two high rollers for the night.
Patty was expected to meet a colleague, Diana Hironaga, and the pair would entertain the men.
Diana was an aging porn star and part-time prostitute who trolled the casinos in Las Vegas looking for Johns.
Diana Hironaga is the key. Police find her hand-printed name in the Del Mar Motel register. She rented room 6 the night Patty died.
And Diana has quite a tale to tell. A story covered with the fingerprints of American aristocracy.
I was just surprised how one wealthy family can be involved in so much weird stuff.
On a hot August night in Las Vegas, two prostitutes are out in the town with their clients. One of the working girls, Patty Margillo, is the girlfriend of DuPont heir, Dean McGuigan. Dean's family doesn't approve of Patty and her ways. But after tonight, that won't be a problem.
The night of the homicide, Patty had been approached by Diana Hironaga. Diana had told Patty she had two high rollers that were they were going to take them out on the town and pay them some good money to be their eye candy.
Patty's boyfriend, Dean, lives in a hotel across town. He knows all about her lifestyle of paid sex and drugs. In fact, Dean has a drug habit himself.
Dean admitted that they were equally bad influences on each other, and he testified that they were perfectly happy living in squalor as drug addicts together, that they were soulmates. And he truly seemed to love her.
But on this job, Patty starts to get a bad feeling. Instead of the classy social function she's been promised, Patty finds herself doing drugs in the cheap Del Mar Motel. And her two high roller clients seem anything but.
And the high rollers ended up being Joseph Balagnassa and Ricardo Morello.
One was a convicted drug dealer, the other was a dishwasher.
Something about this party isn't quite right. Patty may be high on methamphetamine, but she has enough sense to plan ahead if things go wrong.
They stayed in the room for about 2 hours, partying, using drugs, and Patty eventually realized something was very dangerous.
Patty, no, I'm fine, really. Would you excuse me a moment?
She went in the bathroom and called Dean at the Hilton.
Dean McGuigan doesn't pick up. So Patty calls a friend and asks her to pass the message on to Dean.
Her friend asks, hey, do you want me to come get you? And she goes, no, I'm all right right now, but just let Dean know what's going on.
By 2:30 in the morning, Patty wants out. She escapes to the bathroom to try her boyfriend again. This time, Dean answers.
Hello?
Hi, it's me. This doesn't feel right, baby. Come and get me.
Please, I'm at the Del Mar.
Dean said he had been involved in a fight. He had a broken nose. He couldn't come get her. He also said he didn't even know where the Del Mar was. So Patty was on her own.
Okay, babe, bye.
That's the last call she ever made.
There was no bathroom window that she could climb out of. She was stuck.
Patty has been set up.
While Hironaga and Murillo's friend, Joseph Balagnassa, held Patty down, Murillo tied Balagnassa's belt around her head, wrapped it around her head twice, once through her mouth and once around her throat.
Diana Hironaga described to me how she was holding down one of Patty's arms, and with the other arm, Patty reached up and grabbed her hair and pulled her down, so she was almost face to face with her. It was a very brutal way to die.
the men went to a nearby drugstore to buy soda and garbage bags. A crucial mistake.
They found the garbage bags, but they also managed to get themselves on most of the 30 surveillance cameras that the store had operating.
After wrapping Patty's body, they jam her into the air conditioning duct and leave.
Murder, most foul. But why Patty? 3 days later, Diana Hironaga drops a bombshell that rocks the Eastern establishment. She claims the man who ordered the killing is a member of the DuPont family, Dean McQuiggan's stepfather, Christopher Mosley.
Las Vegas, Nevada, August 1998. A murder on the seedy end of the strip is starting to cause some unlikely ripples.
He gave me this one the first met.
An aging hooker has just admitted to helping murder Patty Margiela, the girlfriend of DuPont heir, Dean McQuiggan.
He said that if I could convince
Diana Hironaga says she was paid to kill by Dean's father-in-law, Christopher Mosley. Mosley lives a millionaire's life on Serendip Estate, outside Wilmington, Delaware. He's the third husband of a DuPont heiress, Lisa Dean Chandor McQuiggan Mosley.
She's definitely a woman of privilege, and she's lived her life as that, as somebody that never had to worry about money.
Before their marriage in 1989, Mosley had a pedigree of his own. His late father was an executive vice president of J.P. Morgan & Company on Wall Street.
Christopher Mosley hails from a background I happen to know rather well. His Long Island family is in the social register, but he is no society butterfly. After 25 years in the army, he applies for the job of gardener at the Serendip Estate. Soon, he's a gardener with bedroom privileges.
You must be getting hot.
Christopher Mosley was a groundskeeper for Lisa DuPont, and apparently not a very good groundskeeper because she was getting ready to fire him. And the day that he was to be fired, Christopher said that he professed his love to her, and it was a love story ever since.
Christopher Mosley receives several gifts from his wealthy new lover, like the plot of land on which he develops an exclusive golf club. When investigators arrive to question Mosley in August of 1998, they find him preparing for the club's opening day.
I'm telling you, I never received any message.
Here we are, they're getting ready for their gala event, you know, the grand opening event.
She's making it up.
At first, Mosley denies all knowledge of Patty Margiela's murder. But police have hard evidence. Faxes between Christopher and Diana Hironaga outlining their deal.
Five-step plan.
He just stopped right there and started the confession.
I hired Diana Hironaga.
They're setting up tables, they're doing all this stuff. And here we have Christopher Mosley confessing to a homicide.
I gave the order.
So we had to arrest him.
Mosley says he just wanted to save his troubled son-in-law, Dean, from a string of mistakes. As a former military man, he was on a mission.
Anything you say, Canada, would be against your code of law.
And Christopher Mosley spells out Operation Dean. It's a four-step plan to get Dean divorced from his estranged wife, Linda, to get him off drugs and away from Patty Margiela. If the four steps don't work, he has a step five. Kill Patty and Dean.
So, how are you going to take the mission?
Mosley fancied himself a hitman, a James Bond a type of character.
My operational budget is quite healthy.
Okay.
In some way, he thought he was either impressing his wife, assisting his family, accomplishing something good, and at the same time, he seemed to enjoy the fantasy of carrying out a military operation step by step.
With Operation Dean exposed, investigators have almost everything they need to charge Mosley with murder for hire. But there is one more piece of the puzzle. Step 5 called for Dean's murder too. What happened?
When it came time for step five changed. Mosley advised Hironaga that it changed to where it was for Patty only, not Dean.
In the rolling hills of Serendip Estate, Lisa stands behind her husband. She proposes $4 million bail to keep him at home. But that request is denied.
She made it clear where her allegiances lie, that she was going to back Christopher Mosley in this thing all the way, and that Dean was written off, that she wanted nothing to do with Dean. She did not want to talk to him. He was cut off.
In 2000, Patty Margello's killers meet justice. In federal court, Richard Murillo is convicted on charges of murder for hire and receives 2 life terms. In Nevada, Joseph Valagnasa gets 10 to 25 years for murder. For turning state's evidence, Diane Hironaga gets a reduced sentence of 15 and a half years. Christopher Mosley is found guilty of murder for hire. But because of his cooperation with police, he is sentenced to 16 and a half years. He dies in custody in 2005. Today, Dean McGuigan leads a much quieter life, living in suburban Virginia, where he works as a financial consultant.
The most shocking part of this whole case to me was, again, somebody that came from wealth. Here's Dean, somebody that had everything given to him. But the drugs bring everybody down to the same level. Whether you're the wealthiest family in the world or the poorest family in the world.
There are many problems money can solve, but murder only creates more problems. Even if you are a DuPont.
Over the span of 200 years, the DuPonts built a grand empire of wealth and power. But this family tree holds some very twisted branches. John DuPont was so indulged, he became deadly. His nephew, Dean McGuigan, brought further shame to the family name. They may cringe with embarrassment, but they can't escape the charges. Till next we meet, behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.